This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Hello and welcome to Powerhouse Politics. I'm ABC News Chief White House Correspondent Jonathan Carl.
And I'm ABC News Political Director Rick Klein.
Lot going on, Rick. We had our ABC News Town Hall in Philadelphia. You and I were both there, witness to history. Some interesting moments we want to pull out of that. I also want to rewind a little bit to a moment that I had in the White House briefing room with the president. And it got a lot of attention. The president didn't like my question, but I really – well, let me play it, and I want to play the kind of extended cut of this because it was a question that was followed up, and much of the coverage has just been on the first question. I think the follow-ups are actually very important as well. So we'll play this and talk about it on the other side.
Why did you lie to the American people, and why should we trust what you have to say
now? Such a terrible question, and the phraseology, I didn't lie. What I said is we have to be calm, we can't be panicked. And your question, the way you phrase that is such a disgrace. It's a disgrace to ABC Television Network. It's a disgrace to your employer. And that's the answer. Are you ready? Because
You than the flu, and then you went out and told the American public that this was just like the flu.
Let me tell you something. We've had flu years.
You told everybody else something else.
No, and five times, right? Five times. You ever hear the expression five times? We've had flu years where we lost 100,000 people. The flu is a very serious problem for this country also.
This is worse than the most deadlier than the most strenuous flu.
Okay.
And then you went out and said it's just like the flu.
What I went out and said is very simple. Listen, what I went out and said is very simple. I want to show a level of confidence, and I want to show strength as a leader, and I want to show that our country is going to be fine one way or the other.
So you won't downplay it again? You won't downplay it again? Because you said you downplayed it. That's what you told me.
All I'm doing is, no, I don't want to jump up and down and start screaming death, death, because that's not what it's about. We have to lead a country.
As Rick, and you know, we've talked about this on this podcast, I think probably for close to 5 years now since the president since he was a candidate. I don't tend to use the word lie. It implies intent. It implies you know what the person actually knows, what the motivations are. But the Woodward thing made it crystal clear that the president knew the truth and said something differently. And in fact, he had a reason for saying it differently. Now, this actually segues very nicely into the town hall meeting because that question, the question of misleading the American public about the pandemic, was something that was talked about, brought up by several of our voters, Pennsylvania voters, in the town hall.
Well, and John, talk about what went into your thinking on that. Because like you said, there's a threshold. I know a lot of reporters get pressured on this all the time. Call out the president's lies, call out the lies. I have hesitated as a reporter to use the L word. You phrased it in a particular way, though, that I thought was interesting. And it was a moment. We had the tape. It's no longer a question of if the president misled. And I think you framed it forward to why. But was there something important in the phraseology to you in this moment?
To me, there was, because this was not the president simply getting a fact wrong or exaggerating. This was the president, as we knew from the Woodward tape, who fully knew a truth that he was not sharing with the American people and said something else and actually seemed to have a strategic intent behind it, talking about how he wants to downplay so he doesn't create a panic. So there were several elements here. And I thought that, I think that, as you know, in reporting on this president, I think that one of the biggest challenges facing a reporter, any reporter, is not to appear like you are part of the resistance or the opposition party, as he likes to say. And when you go in there and you use loaded terms like lie, you immediately turn off a third to a half of the country who thinks you are just simply out to get him and attacking him viciously and personally. And I felt that this was a case where that is true. I believe we must avoid that. I don't want to appear like the opposition. I don't want to turn off half the country with the way I ask a question or the way I report a story. But there is something that is even a higher priority in reporting on this White House or any White House or reporting on any story of seriousness and significance. And that is that your ultimate commitment, your highest loyalty is to the truth and to establishing the truth in as clear a way as you possibly can and to pursue that truth for your readers or your viewers. Our loyalty is to our readers and to our viewers who are counting on us as a source of information that they believe is reliable and crystal clear. And don't hide behind unclear language that hides what's really going on. You know, Rick, I think that one of the greatest essays ever written in the English language is The Politics of the English Language by George Orwell. And Orwell talks about how a lack of clarity is more than just bad writing. It can actually hide truths. And can be used to deceive people by doing that. So that's why I went in there and I wanted to be as absolutely crystal clear as I knew how to be. And there were two parts of the question. You know, why did you lie to the American people? I think it was established that he had. And then why should we, not me as a reporter, who cares, but we, all of us, now trust what you have to say? You know, it was, I knew there was blowback. I actually thought there was a possibility he might kind of walk out on me or ignore me. I didn't know what. But I felt that the risk of being in opposition and appearing as a member of the resistance is one thing, but the greater risk would have been not understanding the clarity of the moment and what we learned about the way the president has communicated about this pandemic.
And John, I think this president, I've said it before, but for as dishonest as he is, you get flashes of honesty. And I think in part of his response to the Woodward revelations, there has been an honesty to say, as he told you, I didn't want to panic. I didn't want to jump up and down. And that's one reason I thought the questions at the town hall on Tuesday night were interesting. Listen to how it played out. Our friend and colleague, George Stephanopoulos, moderating those questions from uncommitted voters in Pennsylvania last night.
Well, I didn't downplay it. I actually, in many ways, I upplayed it in terms of action. My action was very strong.
Yeah,
because what I did was with China, I put a ban on. With Europe, I put a ban on. And we would have lost thousands of more people had I not put the ban on. So that was called action, not with the mouth, but in actual fact. We did a very, very good job when we put that ban on. Whether you call it talent or luck, it was very important. So we saved a lot of lives when we did that.
So it's a full 180 from where he started, from telling Bob Woodward that he downplayed, now to saying that he upplayed.
He upplayed.
What does this tell you about the president's mindset on COVID-19 as he gets for these last 50-some-odd days of the election? It seems to me like he is just itching to declare total victory and move on at this point.
I think there's no question about that. I also think, you know, there was another moment in the town hall where he was asked if there was anything he thought he did wrong, if there was anything he'd do differently. And of course, he is constitutionally unable, I don't mean the U.S. Constitution, I mean his Constitution, unable to admit mistake and acknowledge regret. So he thinks he did everything right. But if it weren't for that, I think that if you really put the truth serum in him, that he probably, his regret is that he didn't do less. I think he's been convinced by people that the shutdown was an overreaction. We know, I know, I've talked to the people who advise him, who believe that that the world overreacted to this. I mean, it's a hard case to make. I won't try to make it here, but there were people in real time who thought the actions by the various local governments to shut things down were overreactions, with the possible exception of New York because of the extreme circumstances there. But there was another moment in the town hall where he was pressed about this idea of truthfulness. He said that, what was he supposed to do if he had said the whole real thing? He would have created what he's supposed to do. And the answer was really, well, what, you could have showed leadership. And then it was interesting. Trump brought up the example of Winston Churchill, who, of course, led Great Britain through the Blitz and, was taking over the reins in Great Britain as the Nazis have occupied France and are preparing to bombard London night after night, the Nazi air raids of London. And Trump brings this up, but in a, well, let me just play it.
When Churchill was on the top of a building and he said, everything's going to be good, everything's going to be calm, and you have the Nazis dropping bombs all over London, he was very brave because he was at the top of a building. It was very well known that he was standing on buildings and they were bombing. And he says, everyone's going to be safe. I don't think that's being necessarily honest. And yet I think it's being a great leader.
So he didn't think that Churchill was being honest. No, just first of all, let's untangle the history for a second. I think that you and I have both read a fair amount of British history, certainly of that period. I don't know any reference to Churchill being on the top of a building telling everybody that everything's going to be good. I don't recall that. I do recall.
No, he did run to the top of buildings during blitzes. I don't think his security people liked it, but it wasn't like it was live television.
Yeah, his message wasn't everything's going to be good. I mean,
no, I think he liked the experience. He liked to be in the middle of it and feel it and smell it, and like his fellow citizens were.
In fact, so I went through and I picked out a speech, not from a top of a building, but his first speech as Prime Minister to the House of Commons, and I wanted to make sure that I had my recollections were correct. I wasn't there, but we read about these things. So Trevor Hastings dug into our archives and actually pulled out a clip from Winston Churchill's first speech as Prime Minister, Britain, about to face an unrelenting Nazi assault. Take a listen.
I would say to the House, as I said to those who have joined the government, I have nothing to offer but blood, toil, tears, and sweat. We have before us an ordeal of the most grievous kind. We have before us many, many long months of struggle and of suffering. You ask, what is our policy? I will say, it is to wage war by sea, land, and air, with all our might, and with all the strength that God can give us. To wage war against a monstrous tyranny never surpassed in the dark and lamentable catalogue of human crime. That is our policy. You ask, what is our aim? I can answer in one word, victory. Victory at all costs. Victory in spite of all terror. Victory however long and hard the road may be. For without victory there is no survival.
So, and God, I just love hearing that voice. I love hearing those words. And by the way, one of the great experiences is to go to the Churchill War Rooms, the Churchill Museum beneath Whitehall, where he had his bunker. And they've got an exhibit down there where you can listen to one of his radio addresses that he delivered from that bunker with a very similar message. And the message was one of confidence that the Allies were going to ultimately prevail over the Nazis because there was simply no other choice. As he said, without victory, there is no survival. Victory, however long and hard the road may be. But that's very different from the way the president described Churchill as saying, everything's going to be good. Everything's going to be, you know, be calm. That was not Churchill's message. Yes, there is the keep calm and carry on. The British people endured a lot and dealt with it. But let me just play again. I think it's important. One little segment of that clip we just played from Winston Churchill.
We have before us an ordeal of the most grievous kind. We have before us many, many long months of struggle and of suffering.
Now that is the message that we never heard from Donald Trump through the greatest crisis facing our country, certainly of our lifetimes. We never heard him say, you know, buck up, this is going to be brutal, this is going to be tough, this is going to be, you know, we heard him say, it's going to disappear. It's like a miracle. One day it's just going to disappear. We heard him talk night after night about what a tremendous and great job his administration had done. But I bring this all up because it was Donald Trump in the town hall meeting who invoked Winston Churchill and suggested that his misleading of the line to the American public about the extent of the danger was somehow like Winston Churchill. I think in that brief review of just a single Churchill speech, I think it's quite obvious that that is not a good comparison.
And you don't even have to go far back in the archives. And the president also said in that same town hall that a vaccine is around the corner, that we're rounding the corner, and he reiterated, and George pressed him a couple times on this, but that it would disappear. It will disappear. He talked about what he called the herd mentality. I think he meant herd immunity, but herd mentality was his word as a way to defeat it. And it is. It's been a recurring theme of the 6 months of the response that we're about to beat this thing. That the crisis is overblown, and that his leadership is helping that become a reality. And I wonder because you know bombs have been falling in a metaphorical sense around America, almost 200,000 dead now, and this is not fake. This is not abstract. This is a real crisis that continues and continues to impact people's lives. The president needs this to be over. He needs to create the perception that it's over. And it would appear now that he's in too deep on this line of argument to backtrack in any way, shape, or form. He's going to go with this to the polls.
No doubt. And I think on balance, there were some aspects of the town hall that actually I thought were good for the president. He interacted with real voters. He listened to them. He didn't snap at them the way he, you know, snaps at the reporters when they ask similar questions. He engaged. He seemed actually empathetic when talking about the death toll from coronavirus. And I think it would actually do him, I think that he would get some credit, although maybe now everything is too late. But I think that, it, you know, some acknowledgement of the rough road ahead, of the challenges that may remain. But he's, again, he's used to selling buildings. He's used to selling, we got the greatest, the best, it's going to be so awesome. And, you know, unfortunately, as we've discussed, a virus doesn't respond to that. We have an excellent second half of the show, I've got to say, something I've been looking forward to. We are going to shine a spotlight on what I will argue is perhaps the most interesting Senate race of 2020.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
All right, welcome back to Powerhouse Politics. Rick, we're going to focus on what I am going to argue might actually be the most interesting Senate race of this cycle, South Carolina, where you have Lindsey Graham, the guy that had been perhaps Donald Trump's harshest Republican critic transformed into his best Republican friend, or at least one of them, running in a state that has been dominated by Republicans for more than a decade. No Democrat has won down there in more than a decade in a statewide race. And a race that he won 6 years ago by more than 16 points. But the guy that we're going to talk to right now is the Democratic candidate for Senate down there, the former chair of the South Carolina Democratic Party, Jamie Harrison. Jamie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And I've been wanting to talk to you for a while. I saw that in the most recent fundraising quarter, you actually raised more money than Lindsey Graham. In fact, you were one of the top Senate campaigns in the country, raising more than $14 million. And we had a poll in August, a Quinnipiac poll, that had you tied with Lindsey Graham. I mean, nobody thought this was going to be a competitive race. So, two-part question. Do you think you can really beat him? And what is your core message, your core campaign message, in short, against Lindsey Graham?
Well, listen, I thought I could win this race. That's why I got in it. I wouldn't have got in without thinking I had a pathway to win. And that's the thing. Listen, for somebody like me, I was born into long odds, right? My mom was a teenager when she had me. I was raised by grandparents. We had a fourth grade and eighth grade education. But I ended up going to Yale and Georgetown Law, working on Capitol Hill and becoming the first black chair of the state party. So I know what a David versus Goliath story is. My life has been that. And so going into this race, I knew that this Lindsey Graham is very different than the old Lindsey Graham. I like to say there's a Lindsey Graham 1.0 and then there's Lindsey Graham 2.0. I could not beat Lindsey Graham 1.0. That was the John McCain Lindsey Graham. This is a different man. This is a totally different person. This Lindsey Graham is vulnerable. He's vulnerable because he has taken his eye off of the needs of the people here in South Carolina. That old Tip O'Neill saying that all politics are local is true. That you know, you got to focus on home, and you got to focus on the hopes, the aspirations, and the fears of the people that you represent. And Lindsey has failed to do that. He hadn't had a town hall meeting in person in almost 3 years. But he's on Fox News every other night with Sean Hannity, right? So people pick up on those things. They also see that this guy didn't even stand up for his best friend after the president attacked him viciously. And so folks here in South Carolina want someone with a backbone, with a spine, someone who's going to stand up for them and their families, regardless of who's in the White House or who's in control of Congress. And that's what we are demonstrating on this race each and every day. So our fundraising has been through the roof. It's been amazing. And we've done it not with huge corporate PACs like Senator Graham, but at, you know, $30 a person, because grandmas and grandpas, aunts, uncles, and all are giving us all their little extra cash because they're ready for change here in South Carolina.
So by all accounts, though, Donald Trump is very popular in South Carolina. This Senate race may now be on the list of competitive races that people are watching, but you know, nobody's expecting that Joe Biden is going to beat Donald Trump in South Carolina. So I'm wondering how Lindsey Graham's tightness with Donald Trump is going to play. And I don't know if you caught this. There was a weird moment on, you mentioned Fox News. There was a strange moment after the Woodward news broke, where Tucker Carlson blamed Lindsey Graham for being the one that convinced Donald Trump to do the interview with Bob Woodward. By the way, I don't think that's actually true, but this is what Tucker was saying. And then he went on to say this about Lindsey Graham.
Keep in mind that Lindsey Graham has opposed, passionately opposed, virtually every major policy initiative that Donald Trump articulated when he first ran, from ending illegal immigration to pulling back from pointless wars to maintaining law and order at home. Lindsey Graham was against all of that.
How does that play? I mean, there are a lot of Fox viewers in South Carolina, a lot of people watching Tucker Carlson. How does an attack like that on Lindsey Graham play? It's very different than your attack on Lindsey Graham or the way you're criticizing him. But how does that play?
Well, see, this is what you get when you don't have a set of core convictions and values, when you flip-flop on every issue. You say one thing in the morning and you say something totally different at night. Then you get squeezed from the left, the right, and in the middle. And that's what Lindsey is. I mean, he's gotten political whiplash right now because, you know, people are hitting him in all these different directions because there is no core there to say, this is what I believe. This is what I'm going to fight for. This is what I'm standing up behind. Just even recently, he tried to attack me about releasing taxes. Right. And my response to him after a few days, because, you know, I just don't have my taxes ready to give to folks and they need to be redacted and all, is, OK, I've done it. Now ask President Trump. I mean, it's the hypocrisy of it all. And people are tired of that right now, because what they want, the anxiety in their lives is at such an all-time high. What they want is they just want some political leaders who are just going to shoot straight with them, who are just going to say, here's a game plan. This is how we get out of this. This is what I'm going to fight for, and I'm going to push for you. Rather than have a senator who says, over our dead bodies will we allow an extension of the unemployment benefit, but hey, you know, I'm fighting for you all. Well, no, Senator, you're not. You're fighting for somebody, but you're not fighting for us. And I think that's what you're seeing right now. That's why this race is as close as it is. And that's why ultimately I'm going to win this race. I mean, we are getting Democrats, Republicans, and independents that are coming together. And what we're doing is forming the old coalition that Lindsey Graham 1.0 used to have. That is becoming the new Jamie Harrison coalition that's going to lead us to victory on November 3rd.
Jamie Harrison, just to clarify the point on taxes, because I saw that you responded to the tweet. You have released the taxes. Are they publicly available right now? Are they accessible online?
No. So what Lindsey did was he gave it to a local newspaper, and we did the same thing.
So they're accessible now to local media in South Carolina.
Yeah. And so they're writing up report or something on it. I mean, it's a desperate ploy by somebody who understands that he's in the fight for his life. And I mean, think about this. This guy's been in Washington, D.C. for 25 years. And just now he's thinking about, well, I need to release my taxes. I mean, he's flailing. He's not talking. Every ad that he runs here in South Carolina is a negative ad instead of talking about his record. And it's I almost feel a little sad for him. Not enough that I'm going to relent and not keep pushing, but because in the end of the day, the people in South Carolina need somebody that's going to be a workhorse for them. And we see Lindsey Graham, who's been more of a show horse than anything.
I want to ask about COVID-19 and the response. We heard from the president at our ABC town hall last night, his expectation that a vaccine is going to be available in the coming weeks, kind of leaving open the prospect that it could be available shortly before Election Day. Would you, as a citizen and as a Democrat who's been critical of the president and his handling of COVID-19, would you be comfortable with taking a vaccine if the president says, here it is, you know, week before the election?
If Dr. Fauci said, here it is, and I believe it, and I think it's safe for folks to take, yes, I will definitely do that. But the only person that I have the confidence in right now in terms of a vaccine, who I believe is above the political fray, that where the American people have confidence in him and that he's doing the right thing and doing it for the right reasons, is Dr. Fauci. And so
the president's word wouldn't be enough for you necessarily.
It has to be. I need the Dr. Fauci stamp of approval. You know, that little blue stamp, boop, that this is good for the American people, because I believe he has the technical and the science background. He's, you know, respected by Democrats and Republicans alike. And I know that it's not about politics. It's about what is in the best interest of the health of the American people. And so I believe in him and have confidence in him and what he says.
Your victory would, if you won, and I think you would acknowledge that you still have an uphill fight against Lindsey Graham.
Oh, yeah. I mean, listen, it's the David versus Goliath race of this campaign cycle, but we know how that contest.
But if you, that's true. If you win, you will make history in a very interesting way. It'll be the first time in all of American history that we have two African-American senators from the same state. We got close. We got close in Mississippi with Hiram Revels and Blanche Kelso Bruce, but they were a few years apart. But one in one seat, one in the other seat. But we've never seen that. I'm wondering about your take on Tim Scott as a senator. Obviously, as a Republican, obviously you guys disagree on a lot of things.
Yeah.
But Tim Scott came forward, and we had him on the show not that long ago on the podcast. Talking about his police reform bill, which seemed put forth a lot of reforms that a lot of people have said are really necessary. It didn't go as far as some thought. There's some argument maybe in some ways it went further than what the Democrats were proposing, but the Democrats in the Senate wouldn't even go along with having a full debate on his bill and working with him on crafting a compromise. At least that is the way Tim Scott sees it. I think he's got a pretty strong case in making that. How would you have handled that? You're in the Senate. You've got your fellow South Carolina Senator Tim Scott is making a good faith effort to try to do something on this critically important issue, and the other members of your party are basically not doing anything to work with him.
Yeah. Well, one, I know that is not the case. I talk to Kamala Harris and Cory Booker fairly often, and Cory and Tim are friends. And listen, I'm friendly.
But his bill didn't get a. I mean, they couldn't bring it up.
The chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee didn't even have a hearing for it. At least for something this significant, have a hearing so you can have discussions and you can have amendments and have. Folks give the opportunity to debate certain things and offer amendments in order to make the bill stronger instead of just taking it straight to the Senate floor. Folks can't play political games on these things because lives are at risk. I applaud Senator Scott for coming up with some legislation to begin to have the discussion, but. Again, this is significant enough, particularly for one community, the community that he belongs to, the African-American community, that we want to make sure that we are addressing it in the best fashion, best way and manner for it. And I think had that bill was brought up in the Senate Judiciary Committee and you allowed Kamala Harris and Cory Booker to make their amendments and offer and so many other folks, I think the end result could have been very different. And so that just makes me question whether or not Lindsey Graham and the leadership and on the Republican side actually just wanted a talking point, or they actually wanted to get some legislation done and address this issue. This is not something new. This has been a generational issue for African Americans. It has been an issue generationally for African Americans. And so, what I would do is, of course I would work with Tim on this because this is so personal to me. But what we see with Lindsey Graham is that he just wants to have a discussion in front of the cameras and said he did something and give lip service to it and doesn't really care whether or not you actually get a result out of it. I do care because it has an impact on the community that I come from. It has an impact on me as a Black man. And I can understand why Tim is hurt that he couldn't get the ball rolling. But I think if we would have gone down some regular order, I think the end result would have been a very different one.
Jamie Harrison, if you are elected, almost certainly, I think it would be part of a wave that would put the Democrats in the majority in the Senate. But it's going to be a narrow majority, no matter what kind of wave we see, given the map. One of the key questions that I think is going to confront a new Democratic majority is the filibuster, whether to maintain the filibuster. We saw President Obama recently say it's time to get rid of it, citing in part the way that it was used in the civil rights movement to block a lot of very important legislation that moved the ball forward there. We've seen Democrats make use of the filibuster quite frequently in recent years with Republican control. Where do you land on that? Do you think the filibuster should or should not exist in the United States Senate?
Well, I'm very hesitant to tinker with some of the structures and institutions that have lasted over generations just for short-term political gains. And I can understand why so many of my fellow candidates and some of the folks in the Senate and the Democratic side want to think about that, because a lot of progress has been stalled. But at the same time, had we gotten rid of the filibuster in the midst of this pandemic, we would have millions of people in this country right now that would not have health insurance under the Affordable Care Act. And so when I think about things, I am particularly thinking about how it impacts the most vulnerable among us. And I think about the social safety net that this country has for folks that who are living like the way I grew up, right, who rely on some of these social programs for their livelihoods and how they take care of themselves and their families. And I would hate to see that safety net gutted because of the political swings of our political pendulum. Because, you know, Republicans take control and they say all of a sudden, let's just cut all the SNAP. Let's cut the CHIP program or what have you. What then happens to those families that rely upon those programs? And until somebody gives me a good answer to that, I don't know if I could be supportive of an effort to rip away the last protection that the minority has in terms of some of the things that we need in this country. That's not to say that the Republicans haven't taken advantage of the filibuster. They have. But I do believe that there are a lot of people now that have a health insurance, and if there were no filibuster, they wouldn't have it right now.
And what you learn is your party may be in the majority, and then it may not be. and we saw the Democrats, you know, go first with ending the filibuster on judges, and yep. And then the Republicans go the rest of the way. Both sides screamed bloody murder when the other side did it. But there you have it, Jamie Harrison. It's very great to talk to you. Look forward to talking to you again. Please keep in touch. We'll be following your campaign.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jamie. And that is all the time we have for Powerhouse Politics. For our entire Powerhouse Politics team, Trevor Hastings, Avery Miller, Rick Klein, thank you for listening. We'll be back next week.